If there's a war and the military goes, what do you have to do to support the troops that are out there? I'm a warrior. Ladies and gentlemen, if you do friendly fire and you have knowledge as if, you know, on the individuals, then you have to do something. When you know the health effects of uranium munitions and you decide to use uranium munitions, you have to be held accountable. It's time for accountability to come back in our nation. If you're accountable for your actions, then you have to be responsible. And I don't care what level it is. You know, it just has to happen. So when the warrior misuses a munition or he attacks a civilian convoy, or he blows up a wedding party, or he cuts out down a ski lift wire and all those people perish like they did in Italy, well, you got to be held responsible. That's the only way we're going to stop it. I don't have all the answers. I don't even know the questions. I just know I got to do something. And I'm asking you to do something.
That was Dr. Doug Ropey, former head of the Pentagon's Depleted Uranium Project on Gulf War Casualties and Depleted Uranium, speaking last month in Seattle. Thanks to Mike McCormick of Mind Over Matters Radio for sharing that tape with us. You're tuned to Unwelcome Guests on WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, W201CD Ithaca Community Radio, or Free Radio Santa Cruz. The material that Dr. Ropey has just presented may be little known to the general public, but it's among the causes of what may be growing rebellion amongst the rank and file in the military. The producers of this program have been told by a source inside the armed forces that a significant number of GIs went AWOL rather than be deployed to Afghanistan. The number of soldiers who refused deployment is unknown to us, but apparently was significant enough that Army commanders are considering keeping orders to deploy to the Persian Gulf secret from their own troops, leading soldiers to believe that they're going on a routine exercise and instead shoving them aboard transport to the Persian Gulf before they can escape. A widely held opinion among GIs is that Bush's planned Iraq invasion is about oil, not national defense, our source said. And meanwhile, military recruiters have been mandated access to every high school student by a little-known provision in the Bush No Child Left Behind education legislation. What can you do? Parents with children in the military who are opposing war in Iraq are building a support network. If you're interested in becoming involved, contact Jeffrey McKenzie, and this is going to be his mailing address, in Gasport, New York. 8127 West Avenue, Gasport, New York, Gasport, 14067. You could email Jeffrey McKenzie at chalkalien@yahoo.com. That's chalkalien, chalkalien@yahoo.com. This contact information will also be posted on the Unwelcome Guest website at www.radioforall.org/unwelcome. Also, the Ithaca Catholic Worker is planning an anti-war demonstration at the Fort Drum Army Base in Watertown on December 21st. They are calling all people who oppose a U.S. war in Iraq to join them in bringing a plea for peace to the gates of Fort Drum, and to say no to killing, and to mourn the loss of life from war-making, be the casualties U.S. or Iraqi. Transportation is being arranged. For more info, contact the Ithaca Catholic Worker Community, phone number, area code 607-277-8637. That's 607-277-8637. The next part of our program contains excerpts from a press conference held in Washington, D.C. last summer to launch a website called unanswered questions.org. The press conference was 3 hours long, so we've selected from among the panelists and areas of information not previously addressed on Unwelcome Guests. Welcome to the press event to launch unanswered questions.org. My name is Catherine Austin Fitz.
I'm going to be the moderator today. Kyle and I are going to say a few words about unanswered questions and how it is we got together and why we're doing this. Well, it turns out one of the people who started this question thing was a guy named Malcontent X. Who here has read Malcontent X's work on 9/11? Okay, well, Malcontent, we don't know who Malcontent X is, but he's been publishing, one of the places he's published his series of unanswered questions was on Scoop Media New Zealand. And Alistair Thompson is the editor of Scoop Media, and I knew Miles Thompson, who had been not that far away, lives in New York. He's a software developer. And he'd been not that far away from the World Trade Center and so had a very personal experience. So I called Miles and I said, Miles, would you help us put together a website where we can start to collect and aggregate and build a flow of not only the questions, but start to grapple with answering the questions, because Tom and Kyle and I have a feeling, and some of the other researchers interested in 9/11, that that may ultimately be the only way we get our questions answered. What we thought we'd do before bringing up the first panel is we've started to get an incredible flow of questions through the internet in the last couple weeks, and I wanted to ask Kyle to come up and walk through some of the ones we've gotten, because already it's amazing when you realize that there are researchers all over the world who are working together and collaborating to try and understand not only what happened on 9/11, but to understand the response and to try and get some of these questions answered. So without further ado, let me introduce Kyle Hens, who is a sailor in Rhode Island.
Thank you very much, Catherine. It's been less than a month since Tom and I got together over the phone to set this ball in motion. And when we did set it in motion, we didn't quite know where it would go, but so far we like where it's going. So thanks to all the volunteers who've come forward. People have asked, well, you know, what's your organizational affiliation or your political background, what have you? Where does your money come from? Well, there is no organization as of yet. This is sort of the penultimate and grassroots effort at this stage, and my hope is it will continue to be that. And so essentially we envision a network of researchers coming together and just concerned citizens raising these questions. I've been concerned as a citizen of this country about a sense of oppression. It's like, I feel that being here, I'm exercising my freedom to ask these questions. And it's been quite astounding, the flow of questions just in the past few weeks. Some are general and some are extraordinarily detailed with copious references. Some are complex, others are just straightforward. But what knights them all is a deep underlying skepticism about by those who pose them about the official story offered us of what happened on September 11th. And they hunger to know the whole truth. They cover issues ranging from highly unusual trading spikes of put options prior to September 11th to airline security failures to the failure of air defenses in defending the Pentagon and the World Trade Center. Some wonder whatever happened to the anthrax investigation. Did we receive detailed warnings from overseas as reported in mainstream press? If so, who received them and what was done? Our site's been live to receive questions for, I think, about 24 hours or less, and already we have hundreds coming in. I'll just read a few. People can pose questions and then vote on the questions that come through. They're posted, and then you can vote on them. Now, 134 people want to have this question answered. Who are the investors and individual stockbrokers that placed abnormally high bets, put options, just before 9/11 on American Airlines and United Airlines stock? I did some research with Tom, and we found, according to Bloomberg, the spike of put options was a 285 multiple over the average daily volume of put options up until that date. These are in the trading days before September 11th. Of the companies and individuals who are involved in the brokering, financing, construction, and use of the Trans-Afghani Unocal pipeline, which were party to secret U.S. energy policy meetings with Vice President Dick Cheney? 82 people want to have that question answered. 70 people want to have the following question answered. Is President George Herbert Walker Bush's advisory role in the private defense contractor Carlyle Group and close business ties with the bin Laden family endangering American lives? These questions have to do with the failure of our air defenses on September 11th. After George W. Bush was first informed about the crisis in New York around 9 a.m., why did he not immediately make a change in his schedule and begin direct consultations with the NMCC, national security members and give the authorization to take defensive action. After the NNMCC crisis action team was set up at 8:50 a.m., knowing that one hijacked plane had crashed into the World Trade Center and that another hijacked plane was within 50 miles of New York City, why did the NNMCC not declare a state of emergency and order as many fighters as possible into the air? The question that occurred to me when I did my own analysis of the official NORAD press release is, why did the planes fly at subsonic speeds when we had four hijacked planes? Those were planes, two planes reportedly that scrambled from Otis Air Force Base and two from Langley. And why did they scramble planes from Langley 140 miles away when you have ready squadrons available at Andrews Air Force Base here? So I hope that gives you a flavor of some of those questions that are coming forth. Those, most of those that I've read have just come off the, you know, off the web. I just literally printed them this morning, so I don't know who's asking them. But those are some questions that I've also wondered about myself. And I think there are a lot of Americans out there who would like answers. Before we move on, I would like to acknowledge a few people who are here. Ryan Admonson, who is a co-founder of Peaceful Tomorrows. Ryan lost his brother Craig at the Pentagon. And Daryl Bodley, also with Peaceful Tomorrows, is here. Daryl lost his daughter in United Airlines Flight 93. Elizabeth, Stephen and Elizabeth Alderman are also here, come down from New York. Elizabeth, you are the co-chair, is correct, of the Memorial Committee, I believe, of Families of September 11th, Elizabeth and Stephen. Okay, well now I'll turn it back over to our moderator, Catherine, and she'll make some introductions.
I'm going to introduce all three people at once, and then we'll go one by one. Julie Sweeney, Julie's husband Brian, the ironic thing was, a pilot, an instructor, a Top Gun instructor, working for the Department of Defense, and he died on flight United 175. And I know Julie has been very eloquent in speaking on behalf of herself and her family, but also all the families. Julie will go first, and then we're going to have Lorna Brett, who is the Director of Communications at the Nolan Law Group in Chicago, which is representing some of the passenger families. Third, Mary Schiavo, who is an attorney at Braun, Bedlin, Aristel, Gifford, and Schiavo in Los Angeles. She is an attorney for 32 passenger families from the 9/11 plane. She's a former assistant U.S. attorney and the former inspector general at the Department of Transportation, and is the author of Flying Blind and Flying Safe. So without any further ado, Julie, would you like to take the microphone?
I am, as I was introduced, one of the few but increasing number of people that have decided to pursue litigation in this event as opposed to accepting the government fund. I chose this route for a couple reasons, but my major reason, I think, is why we're all here today, and it's answers. And at first, when I decided to file in January, I thought that that was my only route, and I still think it's one of the major routes for me to find the answers that I think I deserve and every family member deserves in this situation. I want the answers, and I want the answers to lead to accountability, and I want this accountability to be the catalyst for change in our airline industry and everything that goes along with that. I want this never to happen again, and I can't take it back, but I can be a person that helps prevent it from happening again, and that's what I'm going to do. And morally, this is what I feel I had to do. I can't accept money from our government under the facade of goodness and generosity, when on the flip side, they have capped the funds available to be recovered, and they've limited the liability of the airlines for the approximately 271 people on these four planes. They literally changed laws overnight in secret without us knowing that they were doing it, and it's the only time in history of any hijackings that they've ever done this to us. And to me, immediately, that just flagged we're hiding something. And like I said, they're presenting this as, look at how wonderful we are, look at the good we're trying to do for you, and I didn't believe that for an instant. After really researching the fund, it was blatantly obvious to me that the priority was not the victims and their families like they were saying, but the airline industry that they were determined to save and protect. And to me, the only correlation that I can draw is that's like a parent protecting a child that has done blatantly wrong, broken the law, done something horrible. A parent will do anything to protect their child, even if they're wrong a lot of times. Maybe many of you have been in the situation. But in the long run, all that that does is it doesn't teach your child right from wrong, and it teaches them that they can get away with anything. And I think that's what we're teaching the airline industry by sheltering them from the onslaught of people that want these answers that they deserve. I respect that the airline industry is a business, but first and foremost, they owe the passengers protection. It's stated right on their tickets. And protection from all the things that they know, all the things that they've been warned about, and all the things that have happened repeatedly in the past. And Mary will talk about how many hijackings there actually have been, and it's astounding. If nothing else, the passengers should have been privy to this information. And at the very least, the survivors of these families should be privy to this information. The industry should not be run by people who cross their fingers and hope that it doesn't happen to them. I want the information out. I want everything disclosed. I want someone to connect the dots and give the American public the big picture. I feel very let down by a government that I was taught from a very young age to trust, and that they do good and righteous things for us. And that when you put your trust, and that when we put our trust in businesses that are federally regulated, that the government should stand behind the common person, because we have smaller voices than they do if something were to go wrong. And this isn't happening. And red flags are popping up everywhere that mistakes were made. I'm not angry or vengeful. This does me no good. And I can choose to be that way, or I can choose not to be that way. Nothing will ever bring Brian back to me, and I have accepted that because I have to. I don't want anybody to ever deal with the phone call I dealt with at 8:58 that morning from my husband from United 175 saying goodbye and telling me that he would see me when I got there. I hope that this lawsuit will help instigate change so no one has to deal with that again. And I'm also here in support of the McCain-Lieberman bill, which hopefully will help bring about the change and give the answers to the people that need them, that can't pursue a lawsuit or that choose not to. And again, that should be everybody's choice. Again, I will not sit back and be bought out in order to protect an industry that will never be destroyed because American people depend on it too much. It's not going to go anywhere. Planes will always be flying in the skies. The proper people need to be held accountable, and to me, this is the only way we can ensure it will never happen again. Hiding behind the truth is an embarrassment to this country. Admitting to the mistakes and the lax attitudes is first and foremost. We need to know, we need to begin to heal, and we need to make sure this cannot be repeated. Thank you.
Julie, thank you. Lorna Brett?
Thank you. It's a very brave person. I'm with Nolan Law Group. I'm not a lawyer. I don't play one on TV. My role at the firm is to help the families that come to us for answers, to get those answers. I think that we're going to have a difficult time getting the answers to what happened, but it can happen. And I think that what we need to do is remember that public opinion, and that's why I want to thank all the journalists that are here, that people out there every day busy raising their kids, they have 5 minutes to read the paper. And when I'm out there, I live in the Midwest, so I always feel like I'm doing focus groups when I'm out in my neighborhood, when I'm at coffee shops, and I ask people, what do you think about what happened on 9/11? And it's amazing how many people say, we couldn't have stopped it. It couldn't have happened. And nobody could have known. And the truth is that there are a lot of people that should have known, that had the red flags in front of them. We have an agency that's in charge of regulating airlines. My question is, who's regulating that agency? Are the airlines running the FAA? Or is the FAA regulating the agencies? So let me back up and tell you, Nolan Law Group filed the first lawsuit on behalf of Ellen Mariani, who was on flight 175. On behalf of Ellen Mariani, whose husband was on flight 175. Ellen came to us and said she didn't want to go to the fund. She didn't even need to see the first set of rules that were coming out. And we filed our lawsuit, and we were duly criticized by plaintiff's attorneys, by everybody. How unpatriotic were we? It's all about money. It isn't about money. It's about accountability. What we'll get in court is accountability. If we can prove our case, and I believe that we can, and if we win, people will be held accountable. Corporations, the airlines, the security firms, whoever it is. However, we also know that a lot of the information we get in court is going to be under protective seal. So I'm actually in D.C. this week to be here, of course, but to be with my clients tomorrow at the rally asking for an independent, nonpartisan commission to study 9/11. What's amazing to me is that a lot of people are in Washington here don't want this. I mean, we have commissions for everything. How much money did we spend investigating what happened at Whitewater? How quickly did it take us to have a commission to study what happened to the Space Challenger? We have commissions for everything, and we're not having one for this? It really begs the question. And unfortunately, this has turned into a partisan battle. The D's are lining on one side, and the R's are lining on the other, and that is a huge, huge disservice to people like you, to people like Ellen Mariani and our other clients, and to me as an American. I get on the planes and fly. I flew here on business. I get on the planes and I fly to Orlando with my daughter. I deserve to know. So going backwards, I guess lawsuits are going to be about accountability. The nonpartisan commission, independent commission, is going to give us answers. But we are also relying on really good, hard investigative journalists to help get those answers out there. There's not one, everybody involved in this, because there's so much shame. And I really do say shame, and that sounds like an odd word to talk about it, but if you work in a federal agency and you've embraced that mission, and suddenly your agency, and there's a lot of good people that work in these agencies, in the FBI, in the CIA, in the FAA, suddenly their agencies are under attack, and they feel a little shameful about it. And I think what happens is you get into your defense mode. What we know is that it's going to be difficult to litigate this for a couple of reasons. Just as a side note, I'll tell you that we haven't even had our first status hearing yet. On our case was filed in December. We had a conference call with a judge who said, let's get going with discovery. And in response to that, United Airlines attorneys sent a 5-page letter to the judge telling them why they couldn't. They're hiding behind the TSA, they're hiding behind the bailout package, and they want the TSA, the FBI, and the CAA, and everyone else you can think of to be at our status hearing. And I'm not going to talk like I know, and Mary will tell you much more about the legal part of it. My role with Nolan is as an activist. My background is as an activist. I have a lot of experience in public affairs, and dare I even say, I was once a lobbyist. So those are my credentials. What I'm going to bring to the table for our clients and for our law firm is the superior knowledge of our expert aviation attorneys in court. That comes with the Nolan Law Group, but I also come with the Nolan Law Group, and I've been involved in a ton of class action suits that have created meaningful change in corporate America. So I'm bringing all those together for Nolan Law. I guess I want to close with saying that I think it is ultimately the most patriotic thing we can do as a nation to ask why and to demand answers. It's stunning to me that some of the people that have filed suit and some of the people that are questioning some of our agencies have been accused of being unpatriotic. I was listening to a talk radio show, and I think it was some ridiculous person like Imus. Okay, sometimes I love him, sometimes I don't. You know how that goes. You like him when he's saying what you like. And he thought that it was unpatriotic. And I was stunned because I thought the world is watching us right now. If we can't examine ourselves, our federal agencies, our government, the influence of lobbyists and politics on agencies that regulate industries like the airline industries, if we can't self-examine and change and cleanse that wound, reset that broken bone, what kind of an example are we setting? Are we a superpower or are we super cowards? So I think tomorrow is going to be a very interesting rally. I dare say the president is going to understand the wrath of a widow and a widower who's been wronged. And I don't think he can hide behind it. Thank you.
Mary Schiavo.
Well, first of all, I want to say thank you very much for inviting me here. I'm a firm believer that everybody needs to do what they do best and proceed ahead, and that's the best way to get at the truth. So while I may be working in aviation and airline accountability and finding out the negligence and egregious negligence and what went wrong in the aviation system, there is so much more out there that needs to be answered. And I think that there are three important things that I just can't, this way, I always get this way where two watches there, so I remind myself of the time everywhere that I'm bound to follow your deadlines. But there are three important things we need to emphasize right at the outset. First of all, the question is not what they should have known. And I believe I can show you in just a few seconds, the question is, what did they know? And believe me, they knew a lot. The second thing to emphasize is that in every single aviation disaster, whether there was intervening criminal activity or not, in every single one in the course of modern aviation history, it has been followed by not only were necessary a criminal investigation, but also a national transportation safety investigation into what went wrong in the aviation system, and the reason for that is so that it never happens again. This is the first time, and this is the worst disaster, but this is the first time that families have been attempted to be silenced through a special fund, which I believe is about silence more so than about money. Why? Because the money in the end is the same. The money is coming and it's going to be various sources of money. The money could have been made up for the airlines. If you want to bail out the airlines, bail out the airlines. You don't have to silence the families of the victims to do so. And the third thing, and we have to correct this right at the outset, is I believe it is not a Republican-Democrat thing. It is not. I served President Bush 41, and I served President Clinton. I was the Inspector General in both administrations. I saw things that were terrible. I saw protectionism of the aviation and airline industry by both parties. So I really do not think, if you really search and look for the facts, that it will break along party lines. It might break along money and power lines, but it will never break along party lines. I fought the same battles whether I was in a Republican administration or a Democrat administration, and believe me, the battles were there to fight for airline safety. Well, the important question to ask, and I knew this immediately, because I know that a lot of you think that in the days following 9/11 that the carriers got together and figured out that they needed to do something to protect themselves from the obvious facts that would come out and from the liability that would ensue therefrom. And so, like you, I thought that they probably did that in a respectable time frame following 9/11. But from my rounds on the Hill, to find these facts and others, I learned that the airlines approached members of Congress and the Senate to get their bailout and their immunity and their protection starting on 9/11. They sent their first lobbyists up to the Hill on 9/11. And this has been confirmed to me personally by senators and members of Congress. Now, to me, that's very shocking. But to me, it raises another question. Why? Why did they have to rush to the Hill to change the law? Laws which are all sworn to uphold, laws which we are supposed to defend and protect, laws which we now say 9/11 is about to bring the world in line with the rule of law and justice. Well, I'll tell you why. Because on a September day, four planes were hijacked in Islamic Jihad. It shocked the world and would forever change the law under which we act. It would set new laws, it would change the world as we knew it, and it should have forever changed the world of aviation. You think I'm talking about September 11. I'm not. I'm talking about September 12, 1970. Yes, we had an Islamic Jihad. Four airplanes were hijacked. Actually, it was supposed to be five. They were taken to Jordan. They were blown up on September 12, 1970. The laws were dramatically changed. The interesting thing is that one of the airlines involved rushed to court, Pan Am. Not to say, whoa, hijacking is unforeseen, terrorism and sabotage. Who would have known? Who could have suspected? Who would have ever thought this could happen to us? No one. No. Pan Am went to court to say, of course a hijacking and terrorism against an airline is foreseen and foreseeable. And of course our insurance protects against it. Why? Because we know that aviation is an industry which criminals go after, terrorists seek, and hijackers prey upon to make their political statements in the world. We know this. The date was 1970. So in the wake of September 11, 2001, when we heard carriers and governments alike saying, oh, no one could have foreseen this, no one knew that this was coming, no one knew that there were any risks like this in the world, is absolutely false. And we knew that before Condoleezza Rice made the shocking announcements a couple weeks ago about not only were there was there a great amount of information known, but that the carriers and the FAA were warned repeatedly. In fact, in that very speech, the admission was that they were warned at least five times, including specifically, I love this language, that it wasn't a specific warning. Let me tell you, Middle Eastern terrorists in hell-bent on a hijacking is pretty darn specific. And in fact, there are cases in law in the history of aviation history that said, and airlines are responsible for that, whether or not they follow the law, they should have, if necessary, even hired armed personnel to guard their passengers. Why? Because passengers had a contract. And in addition here, of course, you had a horrible, horrible tragedy on the ground as well. Let me give you a little, for instance, of what was known out there in the aviation industry. 33 years after the first attack on U.S. aviation, we had September 11. But there were many, many other warnings in between. I, for one, believe that you should leave no stone unturned in the truth for justice, but you have to do what you do best. So I am personally looking at every single terrorist attack and hijacking against modern aviation. And I even gave the carriers a break. I didn't start in 1970 with the big four airplane Islamic Jihad. I started 30 years ago from September 11, 1972. You want to see what kind of numbers are out there when the carrier said, oh, we couldn't possibly have known this, and we didn't know that airlines were subject to this kind of attack. Here's what we're looking at, folks. In the last 30 years, we have had 682 hijackings. 682. Here's an interesting statistic. When we had the United States saying, oh, we couldn't have known this, and even when passengers were getting calls out to their family, what information went back to them? Guess what? Of those 682 hijackings in the last 30 years, 101 times passengers fought to defend themselves and took down the hijackers, including, of course, El Al, which successfully foiled the hijacking on September 12, 1970, in the original four-plane Islamic Jihad. How many bombings do you suppose there have been? That's what we say we were busy looking for on September 11. They said, well, we were looking for bombers. We were still looking for Pan Am 103. Well, we had 682 hijackings. We had 31 bombings. How about shoot downs? We think that's even rarer. 59. So the thing that we were all out there searching for, the Pan Am 103 bomber, among hijackings, shoot downs, and bombings, was actually the least number of things that we had suffered. How about other unanswered questions from the aviation industry? What about the specific warnings? A hijacking, Middle Eastern, going to seek to attack aviation is pretty specific. We now, of course, know from subsequent revelations that indeed this was being planned as early as 1995. But there are many, many more questions. What about the federal aviation security regulations, which were violated? Both the carriers involved here had record numbers of violations in 98, 99, and 2000. What are they? Well, everybody seems to be hiding behind national security. How about those airliner doors? I think in the end we will find that the doors were open. But we are now asking questions about how do we secure them? What about the fact they're open with the same key? What about this profiling system? A profiling system which largely consists of asking you if you packed your own bags, if you bought a one-way ticket, if you used a credit card, or if you used cash. And on that day, and I happen to represent some passengers who were profiled with some of the hijackers, that meant that they waited to see if you got on the plane before they put your bag on. That was our security. Remember, we'd had 682 hijackings, but 31 bombings, and our security was intent to see if you got on the plane before your bag went on. Flight schools. Just now we're looking at flight schools. Airport screening contractors. Abominably incompetent, the Federal Aviation Administration was told to certify and screen the screeners by Congress. They did not do it. I think we need to know why. Airports themselves had the same security contractors lack security. By the way, they're well represented by former government officials too, by the way, who are out doing spin control saying how great the security was. We need to know what happened to the airport security and what was their success and failure rates. By the way, those are now said to be national security secrets. Jump seat privileges, what happened to those? Targets of terrorism of other airlines, airplanes in the past, those got investigations, this didn't. Why is this now impossible for anyone to ask a reasonable question about? What about the information from the air traffic control? They had information that happened in the beginning. One of the other speakers has already mentioned the scrambling of the planes, and yet no warnings were given to the pilots about specific events that were going on, or of warnings of don't open the door, what's going on, don't open that door under any circumstances. Already there's a federal aviation regulation about not opening the door. We need to know why. Why didn't that information go out? And finally, it was well known before September 11, not one, not two, not three, and even more than four federal investigations showed that security could be breached at will. I know, I led up two of them. My successor has admirably done several more, including at the request of President, and shockingly, one of his was done after September 11, whereupon they found that the security rates of incursion, where you could breach security, were higher than even before some of the exams on 9/11. Why is that allowed to go on, and why can that happen? Is it truly a case of it's just business as usual, it's cheaper? Well, one would think that when we heard the statements, including, sadly, of the administration, when they said, well, yes, we knew that there might be hijackings. We knew that something was afoot, but we thought they'd be traditional hijackings. Remember those words, traditional hijackings? Does that truly mean that they were willing to risk passengers and planes and even the compromise of the aviation system because it was cheaper to allow it to happen than to take the necessary steps to prevent it? That is what we will prove in court. But as Julie very accurately said, that's not enough, because there are a lot more questions than the court can answer, and the only way to do that is with a government investigation.
We're going to jump now to some of the speakers from the second panel at the unanswered.org press conference. Just this weekend, Democracy Now! Host Amy Goodman spoke to a packed hall at Ithaca College. One fact she mentioned was that in New York City alone, 2 to 3 Pakistani men each day are being taken into custody by the Immigration Service. Her program, heard weekdays at 9 on WEOS and Ithaca Community Radio, has covered secret mass deportations of Pakistani nationals. Why this emphasis on Pakistanis? The first speaker of this segment provides a clue. During the Reagan-Bush administration, the CIA brought hundreds, if not thousands, of Islamic insurgents to the United States to train them to fight against the Soviets in Afghanistan. The government now appears to be quietly trying to round up their former operatives, and are undoubtedly also sweeping up helpless immigrants with no al-Qaeda connections as well. Another unanswered question might be, does the CIA know who and where its no longer obedient terrorists are?
I'm Mike Springman. I want to thank Catherine and Kyle and the organization for the opportunity to be here and speak to you folks today. I used to be in charge of the visa section at the CIA's consulate at Jeddah, the principal city of the Hejaz in western Saudi Arabia. There, for a year and a half, I issued visas to terrorists recruited by the CIA and its asset, Osama bin Laden. At the time, I thought it was basically visa fraud. Somebody was paying $2,500 bribes to State Department officials. I was ordered by these same high State Department officials to issue the visas, to shut up, to do my job, and ask no questions. And this wasn't simply a difference of opinion, as was alleged later on. It wasn't one of these things where they wanted to visit their father in America, there was a question of where they worked, that sort of thing. It was basically, two Pakistanis came to me one day and said, we want to go to a trade show in America. And I asked, what's the trade show? They didn't know. What city is it going to be held in? They didn't know. And I asked a few more questions, and I said, no, visa denied. You haven't proved to me that you're going to come to the United States, accomplish your business, and then return home. Well, a few minutes later, I had a phone call from a CIA case officer assigned to the commercial section. Issue the visas. And I said, no. And he said, well, it's important they get a visa. And I said, no. And a few minutes later, he was over talking to the chief of the consular section, reversed me, issued the visas, and these guys took off. And this was typical. I had a Sudanese who was unemployed in Saudi Arabia. He was a refugee from the Sudan. And I said, you don't get a visa. And he kept coming back and coming back and coming back. And after a bit, I started getting calls from a woman I believe was a case officer who was in the political section. We need this guy. And I said, no. He hasn't proved to me that he's going to America and he's going to come back, as the Immigration and Nationality Act says, and as the State Department's Foreign Affairs Manual says. Well, short order, I got reversed again, and he got his visa for national security reasons. And this went on for a year and a half. I had people, not every day perhaps, but every week. And as many as 100 people got visas through me getting overruled on my analysis of their ability to go to the United States in return. And I protested this. I protested to the Counselor for Consular Affairs in Riyadh. I protested to the Bureau of Consular Affairs in Washington. I protested to the State Department's Inspector General. I protested to the State Department's Office of Diplomatic Security. I talked about this to the FBI, to the Justice Department's Office of Professional Responsibility, and I went to a couple of congressional committees. And by and large, I was told, shut up. You don't know what you're talking about. This is a difference of opinion. You don't know what you're doing. You're far too junior to question the Consul General in Jeddah's interest in doing this. He's a guy that was seen sitting in his office filling out visa application forms for Pakistanis with forged passports. He wanted visas for Libyans who had no ties to our consular district whatsoever. I came back to Washington after a trip to Germany, and I was assigned to the Bureau of Intelligence and Research in the State Department. And eventually my appointment was canceled. After this, and after I tried mightily for several years to find out what had happened to me, and the Freedom of Information Act requests were being stonewalled on the basis of national security, I ran across the journalist Joe Trento, and about the same time, I ran across two people, one of whom was a government official, and another one was a person attached to a local university here in Washington. All three confirmed that what I was protesting was not visa fraud, but people being rounded up by the agency and Osama bin Laden to come to the United States for training as terrorists to be sent to fight in the war against the then Soviet Union in Afghanistan. They used roughly $1 million in liquor sales a year from the consulate in Jeddah to fund this. And you might ask, well, as the Washington Legal Times did, that was then. This is now, 15 years later. Well, from what I read in the Los Angeles Times, 15 of the 19 people who allegedly flew airplanes into buildings in the United States got their visas from the same CIA consulate at Jeddah. And according to a journalist in Florida, Sidney Friedberg, a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, they got this through the Visa Express program, where you handed in your documents, and they packed them off in a bunch of other documents, people traveling to the States for a legitimate reason with a legitimate travel agency. Well, Severino Castillo, the former DEA officer, told me this was common practice for the CIA in Central America. They put their guys in, hoping that the paperwork would be overlooked, that they wouldn't get too many questions asked. The agency assigns its people to virtually every section of every consulate and diplomatic post in the world. They routinely troll visa applications. They look to see who's coming to America, either to recruit them or to find out how they can get next to them and get some information from them, or to steer them for their own purposes. There was a guy in with me who'd say, when there's a line of people in front of us, Mike, let me take this guy in line. He's one of my people. So I really think the organization Unanswered Questions has a lot of questions to ask, and it deserves answers to them from the government. Thank you for the opportunity to talk.
I'm not an expert on anthrax. I'm a freelance writer. I've published in the Baltimore Sun, Baltimore Chronicle, Science Magazine. But more than a writer, I'm an activist. I'm on the board of the Aberdeen Proving Ground Superfund Citizens Coalition, also with Military Toxics Project and Chemical Weapons Working Group. Ever since I've been a college student, I've been trying to keep an eye on Fort Detrick. I've written about it even back in the 60s. And a friend of mine told me that right after Senator Leahy called for hearings on military tribunals, he got an anthrax threat. And right away, I smelled a rat. And I started looking into it, and I found a bunch of other circumstantial evidence that I think justifies a congressional investigation or a Blue Ribbon Commission investigation to answer a lot of the questions that are raised by some of these circumstances. I have a 10-page paper that outlines some of these things which was on the table, but they're out. If someone didn't get one, you can get a card from me and I'll send it to you, or you can get it off my website. The timing and targeting of the letters, the anthrax letters, suggests that the motivation of the perpetrators was to promote legislation, namely the USA Patriot Act. Anthrax letters were mailed to the Democratic Senate leadership on the same day that they blocked an attempt to rush the bill through without debate or amendments. These threats frightened Congress in general and intimidated certain opponents of the Patriot Bill in particular. No Republican received an anthrax letter. The closing of the House and Senate office buildings made it difficult for members to read the bill. Many members didn't even get a chance to read most of the bill. It's like 350 pages. After the letters were received, the Democratic leadership gave up their insistence on a 2-year sunset clause of the Patriot Act. The day after the constitutionally challenged Patriot Act was signed, the Supreme Court was closed with a false anthrax scare. Anthrax letters to the news media created widespread fear and a lockstep mentality in support of the administration's policies. The administration suggested that the anthrax attacks were perpetrated by the same people who crashed the planes on 9/11. While agreeing that the anthrax came from the U.S. government sources, the FBI investigation has been so inept that members of Congress and anthrax scientists have complained. And this is the other reason I think that we need to have a commission or a congressional hearings, not just because of the strange coincidences with the Patriot Act, but the behavior of the FBI in investigating what's actually going on. It's been 4 months now since they or anyone has said anything. The last thing that's been written about the anthrax investigation was the beginning of February, and nothing's been said since then, not even from our friends who are watching the FBI. They're just not saying much. Dr. Barbara Hatch Rosenberg of the Federation of American Scientists thinks that the culprit is known by the FBI, but may be untouchable because he has knowledge damaging to the government. That may be, that knowledge, is that the United States is doing illegal research in violation of the 1972 Biological Weapons Convention. In an article by Laura Rosen in Salon on February 8th of this year, revealed that the, quote, Defense Intelligence Agency hired Battelle Labs to create a genetically enhanced version of anthrax, even though no vaccine was proven to be effective beforehand. A former Clinton administration official, Elisa D. Harris, quote, was shocked to read in the New York Times about bioweapons research that she herself had not known about, although she had served 8 years in the White House as the point person for weapons of mass destruction nonproliferation issues. The FBI investigation has seemed to have ground to a halt. Some categories of suspects may be precluded due to the FBI's ideological boundaries and/or conflicts of interest. It is therefore advisable for Congress to conduct open hearings on the greatest criminal germ attack on citizens in U.S. history. Now, in terms of questions, I have written about 18 questions myself. I don't probably have time to read them all, but I'll read a few. Why did the FBI allow the destruction of the Ames anthrax stockpile in Ames, Iowa, 1 week after the same strain killed a tabloid editor in Florida? Why did the FBI wait for 2 months after the anthrax attacks before interviewing the experts at Fort Detrick? Why did the FBI rule the death of anthrax expert Dr. Don C. Wiley a suicide instead of a murder? When local homicide detectives thought otherwise, would the FBI reconsider a homicide investigation? What is the source of the anthrax used in the letters? What is the holdup in the FBI's investigation? What damaging information, if any, does the suspected anthrax perpetrator have on the government? Why does the CIA or its contractors possess anthrax or other bioweapons? And in my paper, I go into what the CIA is doing on that. What is the extent of the CIA's research or the U.S. bioweapons program? Is the U.S. or any of its agents in violation of the Biological Weapons Convention of 1972 and or the Biological Weapons Anti-Terrorism Act of 1989? Is the U.S. developing genetically modified biological agents? Does the U.S. or its contractors possess genetically engineered pathogens which have no vaccine or cure? What would happen if such pathogens got into the general environment by accident or design? How easy is it to smuggle a few grams of lethal agent out of the high security labs? What is required to grow dangerous quantities of these agents from a few grams? And is the danger of proliferation worth the presumed benefit of possessing such bioweapons? Thank you.
And you promise you will put those into the website as well. Okay, good. Okay. Before we close, Kyle and Tom asked me if I would mention two things, and let me just touch on them briefly. In the summer of the year 2000, I went to visit with the chief of staff to the then chairman of the Senate Appropriations Committee that has jurisdiction over the Department of Housing and Urban Development, where I used to be assistant secretary in the first Bush administration. And this was a person I hadn't met before, and they said, what do you think is going on at HUD? And I said, I don't know, what do you think is going on at HUD? And they said, HUD is being run as a criminal enterprise. Now, the reason that that is such a devastating comment, if you understand HUD, it has over $1 trillion of financial portfolios. It cannot be run as a criminal enterprise without the concerted intention of the Department of Treasury and the Department of Justice to run it as a criminal enterprise. And not to mention a group of contractors who essentially run the computer systems and information systems at HUD. I communicated that story, in fact, to my congressional delegation in Tennessee, my congressman and two senators, and subsequent they and the appropriations committees together, all Republicans, remember at this point this was still the Clinton administration, voted a $1.7 billion increase in HUD's appropriations with no conversation. Why do I bring up that story? I bring up that story because in early September, I was very confident that we had a chance of bringing up and finally breaking into visibility the fact that over $3.3 trillion has been reported missing at several agencies, one of which is HUD, but the biggest certainly is the Department of Defense. And in fact, my understanding is one of the reasons that the Department of Defense appropriations bill had stalled and not even come out of subcommittee that summer was not only the various politics of trying to decide how we're going to get increases, but sort of trying to keep that issue under wraps. Sure enough, that logjam was broken, as we all know, on September 11th. There was no problem not only passing, getting the Department of Defense appropriation out of subcommittee, but approved by full committee with tremendous increases. I'm from Hickory Valley, Tennessee. When you buy a car, we pay $350 billion a year to make sure that 9/11 could never have happened to the military and budget. And you know, when you buy a car and it doesn't work, you don't pay more. You don't go back to the dealer and say, let me give you a $60 billion raise. So I have an article that's up on Scoop Media called 9/11 Rewarding Failure. But to give you a sense of how bad this is, the number one defense contractor is Lockheed Martin, runs the computer systems at both HUD and DOD, where the $3.3 trillion is missing. Lockheed Martin stock is up over 60% since 9/11. Now, I don't think there's anybody here who is in this room because of money. I don't think anybody came here because of money. This is for many of us, this is an act of love. But I think my experience as an assistant secretary and then as an investment banker in Washington is about 80% everything that goes on is about money. And I would encourage the reporters who are here and the researchers who are here to keep asking the question, cui bono, who benefited? Because if we're going to be safe in the future, we need to understand how to do that. And if our government is being run as a criminal enterprise, we need to take that into account and move forward accordingly.
You've been listening to an excerpt of a press conference of the group Unanswered Questions held last June in Washington, D.C. For more information on this group, visit www.unansweredquestions.org.
If you have an event you'd like us to announce or an issue you'd like us to cover on the program, you can contact us at our website at www.radioforall.org/unwelcome. That's radio, the number 4, ALL.org/unwelcome. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Unwelcome Guests is produced by Chris Sturr, Jesse Lind, Lynn Gary, and Sean Ewald. We are solely responsible for its content.
You still catch me napping one day and they'll kill me. Then I'll be gone, but that won't be my end. For my guns and my saddle will always be filled by